He's a seaman from Genoa, Italy, a fervent amateur who has the crazy idea of sailing into the unknown to reach India. Christopher Columbus has spent 5 years trying to gain royal support to finance his voyage. Isabella, Queen of Spain, finally agrees. What does the Spanish crown have to lose? It doesn't cost much to finance 3 ships. Spain has so much to gain from a shortcut to India. Treasures, trade, and land. At first, no one wants to board his ship. Finally, he drags together a motley crew of 87 men. Many are illiterates, petty criminals, even murderers, who choose probable death at sea in preference to the gallows. Many are soldiers, with nothing to do since Spain expelled the Moors just months before. Now, they are soldiers of fortune. With his band of desperados, Christopher Columbus sets sail from the port of Seville. It is the summer of 1492. He promises the Queen that his expedition will be a success. And in a matter of weeks, he will change the course of history. It is October 12, 1492, when Columbus sights land. I saw neither sheep, nor goats, nor any other beast. All the trees were as different from ours as day from night. And so the herbage, the rocks, and all things. 3 Spanish ships sail west for 3 months in search of India. Then finally they arrive, 87 men, among them conquistadors, pig farmers, murderers. But this is not Asia. It is an island in the Caribbean. They have no idea that they have come to a new world. The air is hot. The water is warm. They have survived the voyage and have found land for the Spanish crown and in the name of God. They are exhausted, tired, but thankful. What land is this? Where are the ports, the cities, the ships and traders they expected? The natives have seen many people arrive from the sea, other tribes, but no one like this. They will both soon discover that this is just the beginning. Columbus and his men stay for 3 months in the Bahamas and have no idea that they're on the edge of two great continents, about 10 times bigger than Europe. From the tropical seas to the arid deserts, it is vast, and there is space, with room for every possible landscape, stretching from the northernmost to almost the southernmost points of the globe. Spain's royal monarchy made Columbus's voyage possible. It is 1493, and they've waited eagerly for 7 months to learn of his discoveries. Upon his return, he delivers the news in a report to Queen Isabella. In a few pages, Columbus describes the paradise he has found in her name. Land to conquer, converts for Christianity, riches to exploit, and gold. In Europe, no news stays local for long. Traders, armies, and pilgrims carry news across the continent in weeks. Columbus's letter is translated, copied, and becomes a bestseller. Now many Europeans are aching for their share of the treasures. A few months later, in Spain, men are moving towards the ports of the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. Men who have no land and no work. They cross the barren Spanish regions that offer little to live off. Desperados with nothing to lose. Men in need of a job. And the Queen needs them. Anyone can come along. Anyone can be a conquistador. Even a pig farmer can win glory and riches in faraway lands. In 1493, 17 ships arrive in the New World on an island in the Caribbean Sea, carrying 1,200 Spaniards. Columbus's second voyage begins a stampede of Spanish exploration and conquest. Some will go south, some to the Andes, some along the Mississippi. It is the conquest of the Americas. Driven by greed, carrying weapons, and with one animal that does not exist on this continent. With the horse, the Spanish are able to annihilate whole empires in just a few decades. Within 40 years, the Inca in the Andes fall to Pizarro. And the Aztecs in Central America to Cortez. Where there were towns and cities inhabited by millions of people, the Spaniards leave only ruins. And no one to manage the land. Spanish explorers invade the Americas and bring with them the horse. First brought to the Caribbean islands, these animals reproduce and spread in the New World as fast as the wind. Horses have not been seen here since the Ice Age. Now they're back, It's as though the landscape has been waiting for them. Once ashore, a few horses run wild. A new breed evolves, which soon takes over North America. The Mustang. Within 300 years, they have reached the Central Plains and the Rocky Mountains. At the end of the 18th century, the Mustang makes it as far as Canada. ...150 years later, there may be 7 million wild horses in North America. For the nomadic tribes like the Blackfoot, Cheyenne, Sioux, and Comanche in the Central Plains, these wild horses are a blessing. What they used to do on foot, fighting, hunting, traveling, they can now do on the backs of wild horses from Europe. It transforms their lives. This old world animal becomes a symbol of their native culture. Although the horse once came from across the Atlantic, it is now an image of nomadic America. As soon as the conquistadors have conquered South and Central America, one of them heads north. Hernando de Soto travels from Florida up the Mississippi River, looking for gold. Spaniards leave death in their wake, and something else they bring along to keep them alive. As they journey through unknown jungles, the pigs help them survive. They are a perfect source of food. They don't take up much space in the boats. They look after themselves, and they eat everything they can in this new continent. They're prolific little beasts. A healthy sow can give birth to 10 piglets at a time. When the conquistadors leave some behind, they will have an ever-growing food supply for those who come after them. The pigs are key to their survival. But to Native Americans, they're a curse. In North America, natives do not fence their fields, and their staple crop of corn is irresistible. There is no evidence that Native Americans know how to fight this plague of pigs. Soon European swine are eating the seeds and young shoots. Only a few generations after running wild, the animal becomes very different from the typical farm pig. It grows tusks and gets bigger and aggressive. What began with a few pigs becomes a daily nightmare for the Native Americans. In addition to horses, Columbus brought 8 pigs to America on his second voyage. Within 20 years, there are 30,000 pigs on the island of Cuba alone. They multiply, conquering the Andes, the Amazon, and North America. But the Spaniard, his horse, and his pig would never have been so successful in the conquest of the New World without a hidden passenger. It is when the old and new worlds touch that the Native American meets his worst enemy. A very black dose for the continent. A Spanish missionary reports, "An epidemic broke out, a sickness of pustules. Large bumps spread on people. Some were entirely covered, on the face, the head, the chest. They lay in their dwellings and sleeping places, no longer able to move or stir. The pustules caused great desolation. Very many people died of them, and many starved to death. No one took care of others any longer." Deadly diseases contaminate both continents of the Americas. "For the natives," writes a chronicler, "they are near all dead of the smallpox. So the Lord hath cleared our title to what we possess." To this day, scientists are still working to identify these diseases, to trace their paths, and count the dead.
Smallpox was accidentally introduced to the Americas in the 16th century. The smallpox virus is very hardy. In blankets that are used by smallpox victims, the scabs can live for weeks carrying the virus. And smallpox can also pass from host to host on board a transatlantic vessel until it reaches the Americas. And of course, once smallpox reached the Americas, it was introduced to millions of new hosts, human hosts, who had no acquired immunities to these diseases. And so smallpox, together with measles and influenza, had a devastating impact on Native American populations. No one knows exactly what the mortality was. Conservative estimates are about 50%. It was probably closer to 90% or even higher.
Through trade between native peoples, diseases spread through the whole continent. Many natives die of foreign diseases without ever seeing a European. Microbes move faster than the conquistadors who brought them. Some 50 years after Columbus first sets foot in the Americas, conquistadors and explorers find neither towns nor people. No one stands in their way. Most of the people are dead, and nature reclaims the land. Everything that they now find is pure wilderness, a Garden of Eden without humans. A thousand different kinds of birds and beasts of the forest, which have never been known, neither in shape nor name, and whereof there is no mention made, neither among the Latins nor Greeks nor any other nations of the world, reports a Spanish missionary. It may be God hath made a new creation of beasts. Explorers send exotic plants and animals, evidence of God's second creation, on the ships back to Spain.
Hombres, cargad.
Corn.
El ave al frente.
Chili and pumpkins. Domesticated in the New World, unknown in Europe. Tomatoes and potatoes. But there is an unwelcome passenger on board, an unintentional gift from the natives. It will lead to death in Europe. It will spread in the brothels, in the ports and cities of the old world. It will be painful. It drives its victims mad. And it can take a long, long time to kill. This is the French pox, or the Spanish sickness. Syphilis. Europeans have no idea that this disease came from America, where more and more are aching to go. In the 17th century, a new wave of people heads to the New World, the settlers. England has defeated Spain to become a new European superpower. The English crown sets out to claim its share. In 1607, the British start a colony on the east coast of North America in what is now Virginia. They name it Jamestown after their king. This will become their new world. Their job is to make money for the British trading companies that sent them here. The land they seize seems to be the right place to exploit. Forests and rivers, coasts and lakes owned by no one. But not all Native Americans succumb to European diseases, and this land is neither empty nor uninhabited. It is the land of the Powhatan. More than 14,000 people living in small communities, around 200 villages on the coast and along rivers, in large houses surrounded by cleared forests and mixed fields of squash, beans, and corn. These are farmers and hunters. There is no gold, no silver that settlers dream of. Just the land and its people. For a while, the settlers and the natives manage to coexist. This land is rich with resources that Europe lacks. In the long run, resources that are far more valuable than gold and silver. And there's more than enough for everyone. Europeans wanted to travel west to the great empires of Asia. Instead, the new world they find amazes them with its natural abundance.
And they discovered almost miraculous, unbelievable quantities of fish in these estuaries and rivers. One particular kind of fish which very much impressed settlers was the river herring, or alewife as it's otherwise called. And seasonally, these would ascend the rivers to spawn from the sea in their millions. For example, in the Potomac River near Washington, D.C., during the 18th century, something like 750 million alewife were caught just from that one river in one year. It was a remarkable abundance, and people described the rivers as having more fish than water.
Whole shoals are caught in the settlers' nets. In the 18th century, hundreds of thousands of tons of cod are shipped in one single year, sent from North America to England, Portugal, and Spain. Fishing boats sink under the weight of their catches, and the colonies thrive. It takes only 200 years to achieve what had taken 1,000 years in Europe: overfishing.
Fishing tends to remove the biggest, oldest individuals from a population. And by doing this, it changes the selective pressures on the population so that fish begin to grow more slowly. They reach reproductive maturity at a smaller size and earlier in life. And these things all reduce the productivity of a population.
Fish are salted, packed, and sent home for money. Along with them, the settlers send another resource that the old world is desperate for. It is said that there are trees as far as the eye can see, such that a squirrel starting off at the Atlantic coast need never touch the ground till he got to Georgia. This is so different from the Europe they left behind. They have finally found a replacement for something that is disappearing at home: an infinite, accessible source of the raw material of the age. The forests must fall if the settlers are to succeed. From now on, the trees are doomed.
When the first settlers arrived in the New World, they found forests like they had never seen in Europe. Endless forests with huge trees. Penetrating into the heart of the land was also a war against the forest. The axe became the Yankee emblem. At the same time, forests were the great resource the land had to offer. You could make plenty of money exporting timber. In Europe, wood had become expensive, and so the greatest forest destruction in history now took place.
The clearing of forests that seem to belong to no one and cost nothing goes so far that by the late 17th century, many areas of the Caribbean and Atlantic islands are completely bald. An incredible amount of wood is really squandered in this country for fuel, day and night all winter. For nearly half a year in all rooms, a fire is kept going, observes a European traveler. Wood consumption in the forests of New England, just like in Europe, is out of control, for fuel, for building, and to clear agricultural land. The resources in this vast continent seem to be inexhaustible. But in time, fish stocks will dwindle in the Americas too. They create this new world in the image of the one they left. Europeans change America by what they take away, but they change this continent even more by what they bring with them. They come in search of their own land, something almost impossible to find in Europe. They come in search of religious freedom, in search of a better life. They believe they are responsible for their own success and happiness. For the first time, women settlers come too, and they bring a whole way of life with them. They bring animals and plants that are all new to the American continent. Livestock and grains from Europe will transform the New World and make it a true New England. With the newly imported plow, they will leave little land untilled. These domesticated livestock and metal tools have never been seen on this continent. An environmental revolution takes place. In no time, their European wheat is growing in this foreign soil. Wheat, barley, oats, and rye are brought to America. But in the process, some less welcome guests hitch a ride.
Europeans introduced crops such as wheat to the Americas, but in the bags of seed that they brought with them to the Americas, they also brought along seeds for weeds, dandelions, other kinds of weeds, and these are everywhere in the Americas now.
From the most insignificant weed to the continent's greatest mammal, the bison, nothing is untouched. America's native flora and fauna is forever changed. Where the bison once reigned, cattle soon roam. To the settlers' delight, their livestock multiplies more quickly here than it did in Europe. In a few hundred years, European cows eat away the American grass and trample the soil, deposit their excrement, and distribute the seeds of the weeds. The invasion of European insects and animals changes the American landscape forever. Horses, pigs, sheep, goats, chickens and huge herds of cattle take over North and South America. The cattle alone doubles in numbers every 15 months and feed the settlers. The New World settlers defend themselves inside sturdy forts. But there are no shortages of any kind. Meat has become one of the cheapest foods in the Americas. They are the best-fed people in the world. Hides are in great demand in America as well as in Europe. And fur from the wild animals they shoot brings in a steady export income. Some, like the beaver, are hunted almost to extinction. Settlers are not forced to adapt to the landscape. They domesticate and dominate it. Most trees were cut down and turned into pasture and gardens where all kinds of vegetables and root crops that we know in England grow in profusion. They replace the trees they have cut down with their own trees. Europeans bring peaches, pears, and plums. They bring figs, olives, and bananas. And their trees flourish. They never know how lucky they are. Because the settlers also bring bees with them for their honey. The Native American bee pollinates only a few species, but European honeybees can live almost everywhere and pollinate any plant in sight. Gardens turn into plantations for consumption at home and abroad. Apples thrive and become a major industry in North America, eventually yielding a harvest of 5 million tons a year, all beginning with European seedlings. This is biological imperialism in full swing. Europe's fruits and vegetables conquer the New World. But it is also an exchange. It is the Columbian Exchange. European kitchens may not see native meat from America, bison or llama, but New World vegetables make a big impact. The plant with the greatest impact on Europe needs a couple of centuries to take root in its culture. This tuber is insipid and mealy. It cannot be classed among the agreeable foodstuffs, but it furnishes abundant and rather wholesome nutrition to men who are content to be nourished. It is justly regarded as flatulent, but what are winds to the vigorous organs of peasants and laborers, wrote Diderot in his Encyclopedia in the 18th century. Introduced into Spain, potatoes slowly spread to Italy and to northern and eastern Europe. By 1600, the potato has entered Austria, Holland, France, Switzerland, England, and Germany. Frederick the Great himself urges its cultivation in Prussia. But it is the Irish who adopt the potato with open arms. They have a limited food supply, and grain grown here has often been destroyed or burned as the result of war. But the potato, safely underground, survives these hardships. In 100 years, the Irish population more than doubles. And towns like Berlin grow into great cities. By 1700, there is an unprecedented population explosion in Europe, thanks to a plant from the faraway Andes. Only one domestic animal from the New World sets foot in Europe. The turkey. Turkey and a few vegetables enhance the European diet, but otherwise, their life is relatively unchanged.
So, why was the Columbian Exchange so one-sided? Why did it go primarily in one direction from Europe to America? With the exception of things like potatoes and potato blight, why was Europe not overtaken by American plants and animals? It's difficult to say why something did not happen. But you have to remember that the ecological invasion was a cooperative enterprise, disease and plants and animals working together. And Europe remained densely populated. It didn't have diseases depopulate its people. And so you didn't have niches open up for livestock to graze and then weeds to take over the areas that livestock had overgrazed and trampled. So without that critical part, it worked in one direction primarily.
The European elite want more than just turkeys and potatoes from the New World. They want luxury products. Sugar and tobacco meet the requirements of the upper class. The first British settlers quickly acquire a taste for American tobacco and export large shipments to Europe. To satisfy such high demand, settlers build immense plantations. Growing sugar becomes a business on the same scale as tobacco. The new monocultures cover entire landscapes. For this sole purpose, some 10 million Africans are transported to America, enslaved to cultivate luxury items for Americans and Europeans.
Because of the rapid depopulation of the Americas owing to disease, Europeans faced a shortage of labor in their effort to exploit the resources of the New World, particularly to exploit the soil. So the Europeans, first the Portuguese and then the Dutch and then eventually the English, imported slaves from West Africa to cultivate sugar in the Caribbean and Brazil, tobacco in Virginia, rice in South Carolina, and by the 19th century in mainland North America, cotton. It's no exaggeration to say that these cash commodities produced by slave labor were essential to the export economies of the Americas.
By the 18th century, the metamorphosis of much of America is complete. New Spain and New England are fully established. Nature has been transformed and is in the hands of man. Now pioneers are heading west. There is still empty land in that direction. They will complete what was begun in the east. In the creation of the New World, perhaps 90% of the Native American people died. The people who took their place came from all over Europe as conquistadors, settlers, explorers, and colonists. And they came from Africa as slaves. But it was the transfer of animals and plants from Europe to the Americas that really made the creation of the New World possible. In today's chrome and steel cities, we sometimes seem so cut off from nature that it may be difficult to believe the Columbian Exchange ever happened. But in the final analysis, the skyscrapers and the melting pot of the races owe their existence not only to humans, but also to the natural world.
People came to the Americas for many reasons. Some came to make money, some came for religious freedom, some came involuntarily as slaves. But those populations took hold in the Americas because of the accident of ecology, because of the microbes, the plants, the animals that they brought with them that gave them an advantage over the people who were already here. And the legacy of the Columbian Exchange is also still largely biological. And that legacy will continue into the future.
It all began 500 years ago. Columbus had a vision. And three ships set out in a quest for India and found the New World.
The Iroquois call it the Dark Times, a 100-year war. It climaxed in an epic battle between an evil tyrant with supernatural powers and a great warrior who became a prophet of peace. This is the history of America as you've never seen it before. When French explorers first ventured into these great northeastern forests 500 years ago, they encountered a people whom they called the Iroquois. They ruled a vast territory in what is now New York State, Ontario, and Quebec. The French were impressed by the physical prowess of these giants of the forest. What they didn't realize was that the Iroquois system of government was extremely sophisticated and far more democratic than their own. But the path to peace and democracy was long and often bloody. The ancestors of the Iroquois had lived in this area for thousands of years. At first, they were hunter-gatherers. When food was plentiful, times were good. When it wasn't, they moved camp. Then about 1,000 years ago, archaeological evidence indicates they began to cultivate the land and form villages. The villages grew into nations. 5 separate nations, stretching across what is now Western New York into Canada. Up to 50,000 people in all, sharing similar languages and lifestyles. But despite their similarities, they turned against each other. Soon war was all they knew.
The land was in turmoil. Feuds among villages, even among families, turned men into warriors who liked to kill.
For generations, the Iroquois have passed down the story of the Dark Times, when the people of the 5 nations were locked in an endless cycle of violence and revenge, so bloody it threatened them with extinction.
Everywhere there was peril.
In cultures with oral traditions, the line between legend and history is often blurred. Yet in recent years, much of this story has been verified by historians and archaeologists. Hiawatha, sometimes called Hiawatha, lives among the people who raised him, the Onondaga, one of the 5 Iroquois nations. Yet he's not entirely one of them. His mother was a Mohawk, probably captured in battle. Since boyhood, Hiawatha has had to prove himself. He has become a leader of the Onondaga, a great warrior. But the wars have exacted a heavy toll, robbing him of his wife and 6 of his 7 children. Yet he must fight on. His village has been attacked once again, this time by the Mohawk. His people clamor for revenge. Hiawatha leads his men east. They know they're being watched, and not only by Mohawk scouts. The chief of their own nation, the Onondaga, has spies everywhere. Some take human form. Others are shadowy creatures of the forest, especially the owl, the Iroquois omen of death. The Onondaga chief is a sorcerer, a shaman who manipulates the evil spirits. His body is distorted by 7 crooks. His hair writhes with snakes. He feeds on human flesh. His name is Taradaho. He lives in isolation, far apart from his people who fear him. Though the Onondaga have other chiefs, Tododaho holds supreme power. To him, Iyanwatha and the warriors are pawns in a game. Tododaho relishes bloodshed. War feeds his power. As long as the chaos continues, his reign is secure. As Tododaho's spies look on, Iyanwatha's men prepare to attack. The Mohawk often come to this river to fish. It's within their territory, the easternmost of the five Iroquois nations. But even here, they are not safe. The Iroquois are locked in a 100-year war, a civil war. Iyanwatha and the other Onondaga warriors are bent on revenge. In retaliation for a recent attack on their village, they want Mohawk victims, both dead and alive. During the period the Iroquois called the Dark Times, revenge was not a choice. It was fundamental to their belief system, the way they honored and mourned their dead. To the Iroquois warriors, every death had to be answered by another. The battles dragged on and on. The only alternative to revenge killing was the taking of captives. A healthy captive of the same sex could serve as a replacement for a person lost in a previous battle. But transporting captives was risky. If they loosened their bindings and escaped, they could gather others to pursue the raiders. The Iroquois bound their captives carefully with hemp ropes, the same substance they used to carry burdens. This was also a symbolic act, a way of conveying possession to their enemies. On their way back to their village, the Onondaga warriors follow a path the Iroquois have blazed through the wilderness. It stretched for 240 miles, Today, this route is a highway that runs between Albany and Buffalo. But 1,000 years ago, the warriors ran these miles, forcing their captives to keep up. Along the way, they boasted of the size of their victories in pictographs. At night under the stars, Iron-Walther camps with these men. All of them are weary of war. The legend says that Iron-Walther longs for a better life for his people, but can see no way out. He cannot know that many miles to the west, a child has been born who will show him the way to peace. Far to the northwest, in the land of the Huron, a virgin girl gives birth to a baby. She and all the Huron in their village realize the child is blessed and was put on earth for a reason. They called the baby Skenelahawe, but in time, he would come to be known as the Peacemaker. The archaeological record left by the Iroquois attests to the fear in which they lived during the dark times. Towering stockades surrounded their villages. The only way in was through long corridors designed to confuse and slow attackers. Inside the stockade, each clan lived in one or more longhouses. A clan was made up of many families related through a common female ancestor. In Iroquois society, women enjoyed power and freedoms that would not be experienced in Western cultures for hundreds of years. As time went on, the oldest and most respected woman in each house became known as the clan mother. These female elders presided over village life. They appointed the male council chiefs and could also remove them from office for poor performance or abuses of power. In 4 of the 5 nations, this collaborative system of government flourished. The sole nation in which it did not was the Onondaga. There, Tododaho reigns supreme. There is only one person he allows close to him, an evil seductress named Chikansase. She shares his zeal for war and his craving for chaos. Village turns out to greet Iron-Walther and the victorious warriors. They form a gauntlet, a double line for the male prisoners to pass through. A female elder presides. She is looking for replacements for her dead sons. The gauntlet is a test. It reveals which captives are strong. And which ones are not. Iron-Watha has lost his stomach for the violence. His daughter is the only one who still brings him joy. Inside the stockade, the sorting process continues. The Mohawk women and children find a ready home. Men who survived the gauntlet are now offered to families who've lost a husband or father. If accepted, the replacements will take on the identities of the dead and assume their names and responsibilities in the village. But those whom the elders reject face a very different fate. The Iroquois today tell a story of the years before their great Confederacy, when they were locked in a bloody civil war and lost all sense of their own kinship.
In those days, life was valued as nothing. Everywhere there was peril.
Here again, the archaeological evidence agrees with oral history. In a kitchen midden or ancient garbage dump in Jamesville, New York, scientists have unearthed dozens of bones. Some are recognizably human, with cut marks where stone tools separated the joints and stripped away the flesh. A 100 miles away, archaeologists found two skeletons with their arms, hands, and feet severed. One is also missing its head. Flint arrowheads are deeply embedded in the bones. The broken points suggest the arrows were shot at close range. In the ashes of a campfire were found charred human remains, hard evidence that the victims were not only killed, but cooked and eaten. The legend says that Iron-Watha is sickened by the ways of these people and his own violent part in it. Yet he fears Tadadaho and continues to obey him. Sensing he is losing Ayanwatha's loyalty, the evil tyrant and his supernatural agents monitor his every move. Tadadaho will not tolerate any threat to his power. Finally, Ayanwatha begins to think the unthinkable. Could he bring down this brutal man who cares nothing for his own people? Tadadaho's powers are extraordinary. No one has ever dared to defy him. What Ayanwatha still doesn't realize is that help is on the way. In his Euron village, the young peacemaker grows tall and straight. Even as a boy, he's revered for his leadership skills and powers of persuasion. As a young man, the peacemaker learns about the terrible war raging across the lake far to the east. He realizes he has a divine mission to intercede. One day, the peacemaker leads the villagers into the forest. He hacks off the bark of a maple tree and asks his people to taste the sap. If it is sweet, he says, peace will come. But if it turns bitter and runs red like blood, that will mean the peacemaker's luck has run out and the evil one has destroyed him. Then, in a magical canoe of white stone, the peacemaker sets out to fulfill his destiny. As the peacemaker paddles east, Ayanwatha grows stronger in his resolve to remove Tadadaho from power. He too has recognized his destiny. The great warrior will attack the evil chief. Under cover of darkness, Ayanwatha and the Onondaga warriors prepare to attack the remote longhouse of Tadadaho to overthrow their evil ruler. Their task is formidable, but the men are determined. As always when facing battle, they paint their faces to terrify their opponents. Black, the color of war. Blue, for strength. Red, the sign a man is ready to kill or be killed. Their weapons are sharp and ready. Hatchets, axes, and flint knives. Developed for hunting, repurposed for war. Their bows and arrows are state-of-the-art. Unique spiral fletching makes the arrow spin. This stabilizes its flight and increases accuracy. Their fearsome clubs were developed strictly for combat. The most common is called the Gajewa. Its long shaft is carved from ironwood with a heavy ball at the end. What the warriors don't realize is that these weapons will be useless against the supernatural forces of Tadadaho. Hiawatha knows he may never return, but it's a risk he must take to try to save his people. Hiawatha's war party inches toward Tadadaho's isolated longhouse. Shaman is ready for them. Tadadaho uses all the dark creatures of the forest to fight the forces of good. Arrows fly from everywhere, yet there are no archers. From his longhouse, Tadadaho has been fighting on two fronts. He's worked his evil magic in Hiawatha's village as well. Tyrant has spared Hiawatha, only to destroy his soul. The great Iroquois leader, Hiawatha, has been defeated in battle. The death of his last surviving daughter at the hands of the evil Tadadaho has broken him. He wanders, dazed and lost. But the peacemaker draws closer every day. Skenelahauri has journeyed hundreds of miles across the Great Lakes, bearing his message of peace. There are many versions of what happens next. One holds that Ayanwantha comes to the shores of Lake Ontario. He finds shells, which remind him of his daughter's necklace. At that very moment, the peacemaker appears.
Ayanwantha.
He consoles Ayanwantha for his loss and points out how the shells are opening his heart and allowing him to mourn his daughter. Skenelahawi teaches Ayanwantha that shells like these, when strung together, are called wampum. They offer an alternative to the endless quest for vengeance. A better way for the Iroquois to honor their dead. Ayanwantha feels the power of the wampum. The rage and hate that fueled his days as a warrior vanish. He accepts the peacemaker's message and resolves to carry it to his people. This task will not be easy. The Iroquois have known nothing but war for generations. But Ayanwantha and the peacemaker set out to convince the five nations to abandon war. First stop is the land of the Mohawk. Not surprisingly, they are met with suspicion. In many versions of this story, Ayanwantha is cruelly tortured.
Zaleo Onondagahaga. Zaleo.
Finally, the peacemaker convinces the Mohawk chief to listen. The chief agrees to support their cause, but only if the other nations will take up the challenge too. The people of the Standing Stone, the Oneida, are the next to accept the message of peace. They are joined by the people of the Great Swamp, the Cayuga, and the people of the Great Hill, the Seneca. Until there is only one nation that remains apart, Ayanwantha's own people, the Onondaga. The time has come once again for the new disciple of peace to face down his blood enemy, Tododaho. The warrior Ayanwantha is now a man of peace. he is ready to confront Tododaho, the Onondaga tyrant who has terrorized his people. Ayanwantha has won the support of the rest of the chiefs and all the female elders of the five nations. Even Tododaho's evil ally, Jigonsase, has repented her ways and joined the procession. According to the legend, the power of their singing draws Tododaho from his dark longhouse. At first, the evil tyrant mocks them. His power is based on chaos and revenge. To him, peace is weakness. And then something happens that even Tododaho cannot ignore. Another coincidence of history and legend. Until recently, most historians and archaeologists believed that the Iroquois formed their union sometime between the 14th and 16th centuries. But the Iroquois themselves always placed the event much earlier. Only one astronomical event agrees with both oral history and scientific evidence. On August 31st, 1142, a great eclipse blocked out the sun for a dramatic 3.5 minutes. Tododaho understands his tyrannical reign is over. Ayanwantha and Chigonsase comb the snakes from his hair as he relinquishes his powers. This is the moment when the five nations establish the great law of peace to rule their relations. They form a new united government. Tododaho was appointed head of its council, and Jigonsase, the mother of nations. The transformation of the five nations into the Iroquois Confederacy is immortalized in a wampum belt. At its center is a white pine tree, symbolizing the unity of the Iroquois nation. To this day, it is known as Ayanwantha's Belt. Under a great white pine on the shores of Onondaga Lake in present-day New York, the warriors lay down their weapons. They bury the hatchet, a phrase that lives on today. From this moment, their internal battles will involve words, not weapons. They form a grand council, made up of representatives from each of the five nations. This idea of proportional representation would inspire another set of nation builders 700 years later. The Founding Fathers embraced this idea when writing the Constitution of the United States. They also adopted an Iroquois symbol. In the words of the peacemaker, One era was like a single nation or state, easily broken. But a union is unbreakable. The image of an eagle holding a bundle of arrows is central to the Great Seal of the United States. Today, the legend of Hiawatha and the Peacemaker lives on. Not only in the laws and traditions of the Iroquois Confederacy, but at the heart of democracies all across the world.
Midnight, March 27, 1814. At a bend of the Tallapoosa River, in what is now Alabama, two forces await the morning. A young soldier from Tennessee cleans his musket. A Creek warrior from the town of Niyaka binds an arrow point to a shaft made of cane. At the top of a nearby hill, the Creek prophet Manahi implores the Creator to endow his warriors with supernatural powers. On this night, men from both sides, those who will live and those who will die, pray for courage and wonder what terrors, what glories will come with the dawn. The war leader of the Red Stick Creeks gathered in the bend is known as Manahwa, or the Great Warrior. He was once known as Hotlepoya, or the War Hunter, because of his legendary boldness, ferocity, and eagerness for battle. The leader of the opposing army is General Andrew Jackson, a man with an indomitable will and a violent temper. A backwoods lawyer with little formal military training, Jackson was elected Major General in the Tennessee Militia due to his skills as a politician. He is a leader so tough, his men call him Old Hickory. His enemies call him Old Mad Jackson, and will soon call him Sharp Knife. Perhaps Manahwa listens to Manahi and wonders if the prophet's magic is more powerful than the bayonets and bullets of Jackson's soldiers. Manahi is a man of magic. Manahwa is a man of war. Whether magic or war, the Red Stick warriors gathered in the bend are determined to make a stand. This is the site they have chosen. Here by the river, they will turn back the enemy or die. Perhaps Jackson ponders the coming battle and reflects on the long campaign beginning nearly 6 months ago in October of 1813. Now he is determined to bring the war to an end with this final battle and ensure that the mighty Creek Nation will never again threaten the frontier nor stand in the way of American expansion. It is almost dawn. The two forces wait. In a few hours, on these few acres, the fate of two nations will change forever. And yet the coming battle is but the climax of a series of events reaching back two centuries. Both Jackson and Manahwa are simply actors in an old drama that will now play out on this remote bend of the Tallapoosa River, where so many brave men will die. Long before the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, the Creek or Muscogee people lived in a loose confederation of clans and towns that prospered along the rivers of Georgia and Alabama. At one time, this vast region held as many as 60 Creek towns. Some towns contained as many as 100 houses. For 200 years, Spain, France, and Great Britain competed against one another to gain the favor of the Creek towns. Each sought alliances with the powerful Creeks. Over time, the British divided the Creek towns geographically into two groups, separated by the Chattahoochee River. The lower towns to the east and the upper towns to the west. Eventually, the new American colonies of Great Britain became the Creeks' primary trading partner. From Georgia and South Carolina came guns, ammunition, metal tools, beads, and woven cloth of bright colors. In return, the Creeks provided the Anglo-American traders with deerskin. By the second half of the 18th century, Creeks supplied as many as 200,000 deerskins to Britain on an annual basis. To meet demand, Creek hunters spent an increasing number of months hunting each year and traveled further from home in search of game. This pattern disrupted normal Creek life and created conflicts with neighboring tribes and colonial settlers. Throughout the 18th century, the Creeks remained neutral in most of the wars waged by Europeans in America. When 13 of the British colonies declared independence in 1776, some Creek towns chose to ally with Great Britain and joined in fighting the United States. With the end of the war in 1783, the victorious new nation was less interested in trading deerskins and more interested in acquiring land. After the American Revolution, the Creeks sought to protect their land through treaty agreements. In 1790, at the Treaty of New York, the Creeks traded 3 million acres of land to the United States for a guarantee that the rest of their land would be theirs forever. In spite of this guarantee, American settlers poured into Creek country. These intruders established homesteads, turning hunting grounds into plowed fields. Little more than a decade later, the United States angered many Creeks when it began building a federal road across tribal lands. As the Creeks became more dependent on trade goods, their traditional way of life changed, thus creating a division within Creek society. The Treaty of New York helped widen this division by introducing a civilization program promoted by United States Indian agent Benjamin Hawkins. Through his program, Hawkins encouraged the Creeks to move from a society based on hunting and trade to a society based on farming and land ownership. Many of the Creeks in both the upper and lower towns abandoned their old traditions and began to live more like their American neighbors. However, many preferred to remain true to the ways of the past. In 1811, the great Shawnee chief Tecumseh visited the southeastern tribes, hoping to encourage them to return to their ancient traditions and religious beliefs, as well as drive the Americans from their ancestral lands. Many individuals in the Upper Creek towns responded to Tecumseh's talk. When war broke out between the United States and Great Britain in 1812, Creek warriors joined Tecumseh and the British in fighting the hated Americans. This war led to civil war within Creek society. What began as a Creek civil war and ended as a war against the United States is still a topic of debate. A variety of factors both inside and outside Creek society led to civil war in 1813. Often described as a war between the upper and lower Creeks, the war was, in fact, a struggle between a faction in the upper towns called the Red Sticks, who were hostile towards the Americans, and those Creeks remaining friendly to the United States. The Red Sticks took their name from their red-painted war club or red-painted bundles of sticks used as a calendar when counting days to an important event. In either case, the color red symbolized war. By the summer of 1813, the Creek Civil War escalated into a full-scale war with the Red Sticks on one side and the United States and its friendly Creek allies on the other. On July 27th, at Burnt Corn Creek, a small force of Mississippi Territory militia ambushed a party of Red Sticks returning from Pensacola with Spanish ammunition and supplies. 1 month later, on August 30th, the Red Sticks struck back. 1,000 warriors led by William Weatherford, also known as the Red Eagle, attacked and killed 250 Creek and American settlers sheltered at Fort Mims, a stockade just north of Mobile. The brutal attack on Fort Mims, labeled by American newspapers as a massacre of innocent men, women, and children, escalated the Creek Civil War into a larger conflict between the Red Sticks and the United States. The governors of Tennessee and Georgia joined the Mississippi Territory in calling out their militias and marching them into Creek Territory. By October of 1813, Andrew Jackson had taken command of an army of Tennessee militia. He claimed he would avenge the blood of his countrymen and conquer what he called the most warlike tribe of barbarians in the universe. Jackson moved southward into Creek land, confident that his campaign would be quick and a rout of the Red Sticks certain. He soon found himself mistaken. Wounded prior to the Creek War in a Nashville gunfight, Jackson's arm continued to bother him, and the many weeks of campaigning in the wilderness kept him in poor health. Throughout the fall and winter, desertions, supply problems, old wounds, and sickness plagued him. Writing home to his wife, he explained, "It is not fighting the Indians I find most troublesome. It is fighting the indifference and incompetence of those I command. Political and military rivalries, as well as an undisciplined army, played havoc with his attempts to strike at the Red Sticks." In 4 months of campaigning, Jackson only fought 2 successful battles against the Creeks. In January 1814, just a few miles from Horseshoe Bend at Nitechapco Creek, Jackson barely escaped defeat and was forced to retreat and reorganize his army. 2 months later, in March, resupplied and reinforced by regular soldiers of the 39th United States Infantry, Jackson was ready for battle. He marched from Fort Williams on the Coosa River with a force of 3,300 men, including 500 Cherokees and 100 Lower Creek warriors allied to the United States. His objective was the village of Tahopeka, a Red Stick refuge and defensive position in the Horseshoe Bend of the Tallapoosa River. Before setting out on the 2-day march, Old Hickory stated, "Any officer or soldier who flies before the enemy without being compelled to do so by superior force and actual necessity shall suffer death." This threat clearly reflected his absolute determination to bring the war to a swift and certain close. On March 26, Jackson's army made camp 6 miles northwest of the bend in the Tallapoosa River known as the Horseshoe, or the Horse's Flat Foot. In this bend, Manawha waited with 1,000 Red Stick warriors and at least 350 women and children. Beginning in December of 1813, people from 6 Upper Creek towns, Nuyaka, Okfuski, Okchaya, Eufaula, Fish Pond, and Hillaby, gathered in the 100-acre bend of the Tallapoosa for protection. At the toe of the bend, they built a temporary village called Tohopeka, consisting of about 300 log houses. Across the narrow neck of the bend, they constructed a log and dirt barricade nearly 400 yards long. In this fortified place, the Red Sticks hoped to defeat an attacking army, or at least delay the attackers while women, children, and finally warriors escaped downriver. At 6:30 in the morning of March 27, General John Coffey and his force of 700 mounted riflemen and 600 allied warriors broke camp. Coffey crossed the Tallapoosa about 2.5 miles downriver from the village of Tahopeka and took up positions directly across from the village and surrounding the bend. His assignment, to prevent any escape or reinforcement of the Red Sticks. The remainder of the army, about 2,000 men, marched directly for the neck of the Horseshoe. Their mission was to attack the barricade or breastwork, sealing off the narrow portion of the bend. Jackson knew that attacking the log and dirt barricade would be not only difficult, but also deadly due to its great strength. Writing after the battle, he described the barricade as a breastwork of greatest compactness and strength, from 5 to 8 feet high, and prepared with double portholes very artfully arranged. An army could not approach it without being exposed to a double and cross fire from an enemy who lay in perfect security behind it. He chose the 39th Infantry, his only unit of highly disciplined soldiers, to lead the barricade assault. Before sending the 39th forward with their bayonets, Jackson determined to blow a hole in the wall with his cannon. At 10:30 in the morning, Jackson ordered his cannoneers to commence firing. For 2 hours, they hurled 6- and 3-pound iron shot at the logs, but to no avail. The defenses held. Behind the barricade, nearly 1,000 warriors stood as cannonballs slammed into the dirt and logs were punched through the wall, killing those on the other side. They shouted defiantly at the army assembled to their front, challenging the soldiers to meet them in hand-to-hand combat. Of the 1,000 Red Sticks assembled for the battle, perhaps a third possessed a musket or rifle. The rest held bows, arrows, tomahawks, and war clubs. Meanwhile, across the river from the village of Tohopaka, one of Coffee's Cherokee warriors named Tukwa, later known as the Whale, did something entirely unexpected. Hearing cannon fire in the distance and afraid he would miss the fight, Tukwa slipped into the river with two companions and swam across for canoes lying on the opposite bank. Using the stolen canoes, the Cherokee and Lower Creek warriors crossed the river in increasing numbers, attacking and burning the village of Tohopaka from the rear. At 12:30 in the afternoon, Jackson saw smoke from Tohopaka rising from the treetops and heard gunshots fired from within the bend. Realizing Coffee's force had somehow engaged the Red Sticks from the rear, Jackson launched his attack. The drums beat the long roll, sounding the advance, and with bayonets fixed, the regulars swept forward. The first to scale the walls was Major Lemuel Montgomery of the 39th United States Infantry. He was also one of the first to fall, a bullet through the head. The fighting was fierce and the carnage was dreadful. One participant of the battle later wrote, "Arrows, spears, and balls were flying. Swords and tomahawks were gleaming in the sun. The Red Sticks fought desperately, but they were outgunned as well as outnumbered. Many tried to escape by swimming the river, but Coffee's men shot them before reaching the opposite bank." Midway through the battle, Jackson offered the remaining warriors a chance to surrender, but they simply fought that much harder. Slowly, the Red Sticks were isolated, overpowered, and killed one by one. The battle ended. Darkness covered the bend. In the narrow confines of the bend, over 800 Red Stick warriors died that day. 557 counted on the battlefield. 300 estimated shot in the river. The Prophet Manahi was found among the dead, killed by grape shot fired from a cannon. Jackson's force lost 49 killed and 154 wounded. Many of these wounded died in the coming weeks. Some 350 women and children became prisoners of the Cherokee and Lower Creek warriors. Manawa escaped the slaughter. Suffering from 7 wounds, he lay among the dead until nightfall. Making his way to the river, he climbed into a canoe and disappeared into the darkness. The Battle of Horseshoe Bend brought to an end both the Creek War and the power of the Creek Nation. A few weeks after the battle, William Weatherford surrendered to Jackson in his camp near the ruins of Fort Toulouse, an old French fort built at the confluence of the Coosa and Tallapoosa rivers. Though not present at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, Weatherford was wanted for the brutal attack on Fort Mims. "I am in your power. Do with me as you please," Weatherford said. "If I had an army, I would yet fight and contend to the last. But I have none. My people are all gone. I can now do no more than weep over the misfortunes of my nation." Moved by his dignity, Jackson allowed Weatherford to leave free and in peace. On August 9th, 1814, General Jackson and a gathering of Creek chiefs signed the Treaty of Fort Jackson. In signing, the Creeks ceded nearly 23 million acres of land to the United States. A large portion of this land became the state of Alabama. Ironically, only one Red Stick chief signed the treaty. The other chiefs had been allied to the United States during the war. The victory at Horseshoe Bend opened new lands for thousands of American settlers. Rapidly, they built new homes, farms, and towns on what had so recently been Creek land. The victory also thrust Andrew Jackson into a position of national prominence. Jackson became a major general in the United States Army after Horseshoe Bend and turned his attention to defending the Gulf Coast against British invasion. On January 8, 1815, he won an astonishing victory against an experienced British army at the Battle of New Orleans. Defeating the British made Jackson a national hero. Largely as a result of the battles of Horseshoe Bend and New Orleans, Andrew Jackson was elected the 7th President of the United States in 1828. During his presidency, Jackson promoted and signed the Indian Removal Act, a law ordering the removal of all tribes from the Southeast. Manawa recovered from his wounds and remained an influential figure in Creek society. For many years, Manawa strongly opposed ceding tribal land to the United States, but in the end, he was among those banished from their ancestral home and forced to relocate to Indian Territory, now Oklahoma. As he traveled west with his people toward a new and unknown future, he said to a companion, "Last evening, I saw the sun set for the last time, and its light shined upon the treetops, and the land, and the water, that I am never to look upon again. No other evening will come, bringing to my eyes the rays of the setting sun upon the home I have left forever." Stand now above the battlefield. The river winds through the forest, as it always has. Oak, pine, and hickory trees cover the land just as they did when two forces met in March of 1814. In this meadow, over 1,000 Creek men, women, and children gathered for protection in a village called Tohopaka. Across this river, a Cherokee warrior bravely swam, hoping to gain glory and recognition. On this field, an army from Tennessee formed for battle. Upon this hill, two cannon fired against a stout log barricade that crossed this ground once defended by 1,000 Red Stick warriors. On this grass-covered field, and in this dark flowing water of the Tallapoosa, poured the blood of two nations. Now, all is quiet and still. But what happened here in a single day, on a 100-acre bend of the Tallapoosa River, forever shaped our history.
Florida, 1928. Bulldozers cleared the way for a new highway, U.S. 41, the Tamiami Trail. The road opens an area of Florida that has been virtually inaccessible to most of the state's population for years. The forbidding swamps of the Everglades. In and around these marshes and bogs live remnants of a Native American people who once held at bay the combined might of the United States Army, Navy, and Marines. Thousands of lives and tens of millions of dollars were lost attempting to eradicate them.
The whole intent was to wipe out the Indians totally from the southeast or remove them. If they wouldn't go, they were going to kill them.
But the people of this land, the Seminoles, stood and fought. They waged a hit-and-run guerrilla war unlike anything America had ever before experienced. For the United States, fighting on alien terrain against a determined, elusive foe was a grim foreshadowing of another jungle quagmire. One that would baffle U.S. forces in Southeast Asia more than a century later.
If you corner an alligator or a rattlesnake, they tend to turn around and bite you or fight back for survival. The Seminole Indians were the same way.
Ponce de Leon, a Spaniard who had once sailed with Columbus, sets foot on a mysterious land he names after the Easter Feast of Flowers, Pascua Florida, Florida. Legend says Ponce de Leon was searching this land for the fabled Fountain of Youth. But in reality, he is just one of many Spanish explorers and colonizers who sailed to Florida for power and plunder. Hernando de Soto, Pancho de Narváez, Cabeza de Vaca, the conquistadors marched through Florida determined to dominate the so-called New World of North America.
They were for glory, God, and gold. There was nothing else in the equation. Nothing else. And that was what the native people experienced.
When the Spaniards arrive in the 16th century, there are more than 500,000 Native Americans living in Florida. Such people as the Apalaches, the Timucuins, and the Colusas. They fiercely resist the Spaniards, but are no match for their firepower, their relentless slave raiding, and the devastating diseases they bring from across the sea. In fewer than 200 years, hundreds of thousands of Florida natives are dead. On the borders of Spanish Florida, other native peoples are flourishing. The Muscogee-speaking tribes, dubbed the Creek Indians by the British, inhabit at least 60 villages in Alabama and Georgia. But pressures from U.S. settlers have many of them looking for a new home. They join with the few surviving Florida Indians and other tribes who have migrated south to Spanish Florida. All become known as Seminoles, a word meaning renegades.
So they're trying to create some coalition and trying to get along with one another. And the government then said, you're all Seminoles. And of course, some of the people didn't understand what they meant by that. All of a sudden, you're this group of people that never existed before.
William Bartram, a naturalist traveling throughout Spanish Florida in the late 18th century, marvels at the land of the Seminoles.
I can venture to assert that no part of the globe saw abounds of creatures fit for the food of man. The Seminoles seem to be free from want or desires. No cruel enemy to dread, nothing to give them disquietude.
All of that is about to change. 1813. Encroaching white settlement drives the Red Stick faction of the Creeks to war. The next year, General Andrew Jackson crushes the Red Sticks at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. The Creeks surrender over two-thirds of their territory, 20 million acres, to Jackson and the United States.
As a result of the Horseshoe Bend battle, many of those people that were left moved to Florida and became a part of what we now know as the Seminole Nation.
Among those on the run is a 10-year-old boy who will become a leader of Seminole resistance against the United States. His white father has named him Billy Powell. To his brothers and his enemies, he will be known as Osceola.
They came as refugees after a war, and they came with what they could carry, and they came with shreds of their lives to try to find some peaceful place where they could put those lives back together. And they thought that that place would be Florida.
Another group of people also seek sanctuary among the Seminoles. Blacks, fleeing the horrors of slavery in the United States. In Spanish Florida, the runaway slaves join other blacks working and living with the Indians.
It became quite a thing to flee into Florida by the hundreds, and it was quite productive. They could raise crops right next to the Indians. They married Indians. They became a part of the frontier. They raised their families, they raised their grandchildren, and they died right here in Florida.
The blacks and Seminoles discover they have much in common. Many African traditions, including social structures and religious beliefs, are very similar to those of the Indians. But nothing strengthens their bond more than a common enemy, the white Americans. Stinging from the memory of the lash, the blacks warn the Seminoles never to trust the United States government.
Once you've gained your freedom, you know, for the most part, once you've had that taste of freedom, they probably made up their mind that, hey, you know, they may come for me someday, but I'll never accept going back into that way of life ever again.
Southern slaveholders are angry that blacks are escaping to Spanish Florida. What especially galls them is the existence of a small fort 60 miles from Georgia on the Apalachicola River. Known as the Negro Fort, it is manned by runaway slaves. This infuriates General Andrew Jackson.
If the fort harbors the Negroes of our citizens, or holds out inducements to the slaves to desert from their owner's service, this fort must be destroyed.
Acting on his own and blatantly invading the territory of another country, Jackson orders an attack. July July 27, 1816. Gunboats hurl 8 cannonballs at the Negro fort. None do much damage. A 9th cannonball is heated in a ship's galley and fired. The ball ignites barrels of gunpowder in the fort. 300 are killed. An American eyewitness writes his father,
"You cannot conceive, nor can I describe, the horrors of the scene. In an instant, hundreds of lifeless bodies were stretched upon the plain, buried in sand and rubbish, or suspended from the tops of the surrounding pines."
After describing the carnage at the fort, the young man adds a postscript.
"First-rate land can be purchased in Florida for 50 cents per acre." What speculation! If it should ever be ours, which I think will be the case.
For it is not only runaway slaves who are drawing American attention to Spanish Florida. It is the promise of more land, of a strategic territory that can give the United States control of its coasts and the Caribbean. America needs Florida, one observer notes, like a body needs a foot. The Secretary of War gives Andrew Jackson permission to invade the Spanish territory. Once again, the Creeks and Seminoles face the wrath of Old Hickory, the man they call Sharp Knife.
What could they think but he has come for us? He's followed us, he's found us. And there's no running further. We don't have any place else to go. We either hide or fight.
Jackson's troops torch Indian houses and towns and seize the city of Pensacola, all without a formal declaration of war. The Spanish government, weakened by other foreign conflicts and colonial revolts, cannot put up a fight. In 1819, Spain cedes its Florida territory to the United States. Andrew Jackson thinks he has wiped out the Seminole problem. But though their homes may be gone, the people live still praying for peace.
The Seminoles did want to be left alone. They wanted to be what I would consider just to live as they have lived for the past centuries, to be free.
But an impatient America will not let them be. Florida is now part of the United States, and its white citizens constantly clamor. The Seminoles are in the way. They must go, preferably west of the Mississippi River. The Seminoles do not understand why everyone cannot coexist. But they agree to meet with United States officials at Moultrie Creek near St. Augustine to discuss a government mandate that they be moved to a reservation in the center of the Florida Peninsula. An aging head chief named Niamatla pleads to remain in his homeland.
"We hope you will not send us south to a country where neither the hickory nut, the acorn, nor the persimmon grows. I am attached to the spot improved by my own labor, and cannot believe my friends will drive me from it.
Despite Niamatla's plea, the Seminoles say they will move to the reservation. They find their new lands harsh and inhospitable.
They were reduced to just really bare subsistence. And a person starving is an angry person. A person starving is a person who has lost hope, perhaps.
Many of the Seminoles refuse to stay on the reservation. Hungry and frustrated, from time to time, they raid towns and plantations, further infuriating white Floridians. What's more, there is the burning issue that refuses to die: slavery. Many slaveholders fear that the presence of escaped blacks in Florida will incite slave insurrections. Whites are permitted to search the reservation for runaways. Often, they steal away blacks who have never even been slaves. Territorial Governor William Pope Duval warns the Seminoles.
By the treaty, you are bound to deliver all the Negroes that do not belong to the Indians. This you have not done. You are not to mind what the Negroes say. They care nothing for you, further than to make use of you to keep out of the hands of their masters.
But the Seminoles will not betray their allies and friends, and the blacks are determined to stay free.
This had been like a piece of heaven to them. They had built, they had harvested, they had reared their children, and here were a group of people coming in saying that we own you.
In 1830, their old nemesis, Andrew Jackson, is now President of the United States. Congress passes the Indian Removal Act. Forced migration westward across the Mississippi must begin now. Georgia's Indian Commissioner, Colonel James Gadsden, is sent to Payne's Landing, Florida, to formalize a new treaty.
The absolute bottom line on the Treaty of Payne's Landing was, you will not stay in Florida, we will not negotiate a space, you will leave.
The Payne's Landing Treaty is one of several, but all say the same thing: get out. The Seminoles, who have run too many times, do not want to go.
This is my home. I built this home. I built this log cabin. That's my wife. That's my children. This is where I live. They didn't want to move. And who would want to move? I wouldn't want to move. I want to stay right there, you know, because it's my home. I don't care if it's an old shack, if it's my home, that's where I want to be.
April 3rd, 1835. In Florida, Indian agent Wiley Thompson reads one of the treaties to a group of Seminole leaders. One of them is incensed at what he hears.
The white people got some of our chiefs to sign a paper to give our lands to them. But our chiefs did not do as we told them to do. They done wrong. We must do right. When the agent tells me to go from my home, I hate him, because I love my home, and I will not go from it.
He is Osceola, the man who, as a boy, fled Andrew Jackson and his soldiers. Like most Seminoles, Osceola had hoped to coexist peacefully with the Americans in Florida.
But Thompson's message of removal leaves him bewildered and enraged.
I believe that this is the moment when everything changed in Osceola's mind. This is the moment when Osceola said to himself, Thompson will pay. And they'll see. They'll see just exactly what it means to the Indians to be pushed one more time.
Although some of the chiefs agreed to emigrate west of the Mississippi to Indian territory, what is now Oklahoma, Osceola becomes a leader of the resistance. The black Seminoles, fearful of returning to slavery, side with him. Osceola knows that only drastic action will show Seminole resistance is real. He helps plan a series of actions that will prove they mean business. Thursday, October 26, 1835. Charlie Amatla, a Seminole leader, is riding back to his camp with money the government has given him to emigrate. Osceola shoots Charlie Amatla dead. He leaves the body on the trail, the money strewn around the corpse. It is a message. This is what happens to those who betray their people and homeland.
What a lot of people don't realize is Charlie Amatla and Osceola were friends. They were close. But we've got to understand that sometimes in a case of one survival and the survival of the overall society of people, that there has to be decisions made.
Friendship will not stand in the way of Osceola's fierce determination. And he will exact punishment on the Indian agent who has so arrogantly insisted that the Seminoles vanish west. December 28, 1835, 2 months after Charlie Amatla's death. Wiley Thompson and a friend, Lieutenant Constantine Smith, had finished dinner and are walking just outside the walls of Fort King. Both men are killed. Smith has two bullets in his body. Wiley Thompson, 14. Osceola has his revenge.
I think they just took all they could take. They went to the limit of human endurance as leaders to protect what they had, and they're simply willing to fight. But the fact is, we're going to fight to the end.
Evening, December 27, 1835. Central Florida. Major Francis Dade and two companies of soldiers are resting. They have been on the move for 4 days, a relief column headed for Fort King. So far, the trip has been uneventful.
Then the morning of the 28th of December, it was a drizzle of rain falling. The temperature was some 48 degrees, quite chilly. Major Dade called out to the men and told them that I can't tell you to put your weapons on the supply wagon, as it would be unmilitary. But you can carry them under your coats to keep your powder dry because of this drizzle of rain.
8 a.m., cold and wet. The men march along the road between a lake and the Wahoo Swamp. Major Dade assures them they are safe. We have now got through the danger, he says. Keep up good heart, and when we get to Fort King, I'll give you 3 days off for Christmas.
Next moment,
quite literally, out to the north and out to the west, all alongside this column of men. What looked to them like 1,000 Seminole Indians stepped out from behind the pine trees, rose up from the palmetto, and at point-blank range, they fired into the faces of the command strung down this road. Probably close to half the command, some 100 men, fell in their tracks, either dead or wounded.
Captain George Washington Gardner tries to bring order to chaos.
He stood in the road and swung his sword in the air, and even the Indians later recalled having seen him and heard him, and he shouted up and down this column, "God damn, God damn." And I think it sums up very well in a couple of words the absolute terror, frustration, but determination of this command.
Several hours after the battle began, all but one of Dade's men are dead. That night, in the Wahoo Swamp, the Seminoles celebrate their victory. Osceola rides into camp and presents a medicine man with the scalp of Wiley Thompson, who he has killed that very afternoon. The Dade battle and Thompson's murder have been carefully coordinated. Osceola gives the whites a warning.
"You have guns. And so do we. You have powder, and so do we. You have men, and so have we. Your men will fight, and so will ours, until the last drop of blood has moistened the dust of its hunting grounds."
Osceola continues his attacks, and fellow war leader Wildcat strikes in eastern Florida. The United States commits 5,000 men to the war. They are charged with tracking down some 1,500 warriors.
It was either go to Oklahoma or die. So what is the person to do? You know, when your home is threatened, you fight.
The finest generals of the U.S. command step into the fray, including the great Winfield Scott, Old Fuss and Feathers, hero of 1812 and the Black Hawk War. He arrives with a full military brass band and a thorough knowledge of European military strategies. They will do him little good in Florida.
It was actually one of the first forms of true jungle guerrilla warfare that the military ever really experienced. And it became a very difficult task to try to remove these people from their homelands.
The military strides in, only to find itself bogged down in mud and antiquated tactics. The blue of their uniforms, the noise they make. The men are walking targets.
It was so bad that men fought the terrain almost as much as they fought the Indians. The climate, the fact that it was either abysmally hot or abysmally cold, that when you were cold, you were also wet, and when you were hot, you were also wet. The fact that they were never quite walking on land, but they weren't quite walking in water, made this a really difficult place to be.
three generals, including Winfield Scott, go down in defeat. December 1836, General Thomas S. Jessup takes command of 8,000 soldiers and volunteers. His orders: beat the Seminoles with whatever it takes and ship whoever is still alive out to Indian territory. After a year of little success, Jessup decides that the only way to defeat the Seminoles is to lure them in under a white flag of truce. Tricked into believing the army wants to talk peace, hundreds of war-weary Seminoles are captured and sent west.
Another violation, another lie, another way of taking our land in a less than noble way. But to be taken over under a flag of truce was unthinkable.
The course that Jessup finally decided to take was without doubt an indication of his own personal desperation and the desperation of the United States to do something, to bring this conflict to a close, to settle this Seminole question.
2 years of war and life on the run are taking their toll on the Seminoles. An ailing Osceola and his comrade Wildcat hope to negotiate a settlement with Jessup. But they too are duped by the false white flag. Surrounded by hundreds of soldiers, Osceola, who had stood as a fiery symbol of Seminole defiance, is now a prisoner of war. He is paraded through the streets of St. Augustine and imprisoned at Fort Marion. December 1837. As hundreds of disheartened Seminoles are captured and dispatched west, the government decides to ship Osceola north to a harbor fort in Charleston, South Carolina. Osceola becomes a tourist attraction as sightseers crowd to gawk at him. He is weak and weary, ill with malaria, and quinsy, an infected, inflamed, sore throat. George Catlin, the artist who chronicled so much of what we know about 19th century Native American life, arrives to paint his portrait. "He is a most extraordinary man," Catlin writes.
"And one entitled to a better fate. He is grieving with a broken spirit and ready to die, cursing the white man, no doubt, to the end of his breath."
January 30th, 1838. Unable to talk, the 33-year-old Osceola signals his wives to bring him his full war dress. He paints his face, knowing that sickness is going to end his life. He shakes hands with everyone in the room, including physician Frederick Wheaton.
He made a signal for them to lower him down upon his bed. He then slowly drew from his war belt his scalping knife, which he firmly grasped in his right hand, and in a moment smiled away his last breath without a struggle or a groan.
He was just the epitome of life for the Seminole. Very proud people. People who were tied to the land for very spiritual reasons. A group of people who love their families and would do anything to protect and defend their family and their home.
Although Osceola has been the emblem of their fight to stay in Florida, his dying does not end the struggle. The Seminoles, both natives and blacks, vow to fight on. Wildcat, the Seminole leader who had been captured with Osceola, has succeeded in a daring escape from the Fort Marion prison.
These people believed that they were going to die anyway, and so they fasted and got to the point where they were pretty small and was able to scale the wall and to loosen the bars, take them out. The opening was only 7 to 8 inches wide with two bars. One night, these Seminoles were able to scale the wall, go out that opening, and drop 24 feet down on the outside to a moat.
Wildcat flees south and reunites with Seminole warriors near Lake Okeechobee. Christmas Day, 1837. A future American president, Colonel Zachary Taylor, pursues the Seminoles into their Okeechobee sanctuary. With him are 800 regular soldiers and 200 Missouri volunteers. At the first volley from the Seminoles, the volunteers flee. But Taylor's regulars stay in line. The Battle of Okeechobee is the largest of the war, the last time the warriors and soldiers will meet in such numbers. The Seminoles fight bravely, but are pushed further south, into the murky swamps of the Everglades. Nothing they do seems to stop the relentless demands of the whites to get out or die. Members of Congress protest the expense and loss of life, but the skirmishes grind on, year after year, a frustrating war of attrition. Many Seminoles cling to the hope that the United States will finally relent and let them hold on to some small plot of land. They are hungry and sick, but they will not give in.
You couldn't keep a child who was under 3 years old because they had to eat. Mother's milk failed because mothers didn't have enough food or drink, and they cried. And they can be very loud when they cry. So sometimes, in order for the survival of all the other people and children, they had to, you know, snuff the child that was crying. They didn't intend to, but if there was somebody real close by, they would put their hands over the mouth. And you can't really do that without suffocating the child. So that sometimes it was accidental, and sometimes they had to do it on purpose.
One by one, many of the Seminoles decide there is no alternative to emigration.
Some of the old people decided that they would not move to the new territory, that they would die on the Florida land, and they stayed behind. But some of them who had still full lives ahead of them wanted to see the welfare of their children, of their band, and of their people to still replenish and start over again, I guess you could say. They decided to move and to go to Indian territory.
October 1841. Even the great warrior Wildcat has been captured. He and his people prepare to sail for New Orleans and the trek to Indian territory.
I am looking at the last pine trees on my land. It was my home. I love it. And to leave it now is like burying my wife and child. I have thrown away my rifle and taken the hand of the white man. And now say to him, take care of me.
It was a time where once that they knew they were loaded up on the barges or the ships, that they knew they would never see that land that their ancestors had lived and abided on for hundreds of years. But to know that you're leaving and you're never going to return, that's almost like saying that being that their home was as a mother to them, that would like you having to go away and you're saying goodbye to your mother. And you know you would never see her again after this last time that you laid eyes on her. You would never see her again. Those are the type of feelings that those people that were leaving Florida perhaps could have felt.
August 14th, 1842. It has been more than 6.5 years since the death of Wiley Thompson and the killings at the Dade Battle. Deciding that further fighting is senseless, General William Jenkins Worth declares the war at an end.
Didn't end because there was any clear victory. The war didn't end, if it did really end, because one side capitulated. The war ended because the United States ultimately got sick and tired of fighting it. And because public clamor was such and congressional opinion was such that the United States government no longer wished to appropriate funds for the prosecution of what appeared to be a losing war, a war which simply could not be won. And so in 1842, it was decided by the United States government unilaterally that the war would be declared at a close.
More than 2,000 American soldiers have died, and untold hundreds of Seminoles. 3,000 have been removed to Indian territory. To achieve this, Washington has spent $40 million, the equivalent of more than $7 billion today. But in spite of all the money and all the bloodshed, the government never truly defeats the Seminoles. At war's end, 300 still remain in Florida. Having successfully resisted for so long, they are allowed to stay. To these survivors, the United States has given in.
There was a certain faction, Seminoles, that can actually officially say that they did not come to the point where they said, we surrender, we give up. The ones who would never officially surrender or sign a peace treaty with the government in the time of conflict with the United States. They became the ones who would be known as the unconquered.